Friends, gentlemen, there will be no doubt about it at all.
35. Special Delivery. Commander Norton was sleeping soundly when his personal communicator dragged him away from happy dreams. He had been holidaying with his family on Mars, flying past the awesome, snow-capped peak of Nix Olympica, mightiest volcano in the solar system. Little Billy had started to say something to him. Now he would never know what it was. The dream faded. The reality was his executive officer up on the ship. "Sorry to wake you, Skipper," said Kirchhoff. "AAA priority from headquarters." "Let me have it," Norton answered sleepily. "I can't. It's in code. Commander's eyes only." Norton was instantly awake. He had received such a message only 3 times in his whole career, and on each occasion, it had meant trouble. "Damn," he said. "What do we do now?" The exec did not bother to answer. Each understood the problem perfectly. It was one that ship's orders had never anticipated. Normally, a commander was never more than a few minutes away from his office and the codebook in his personal safe. If he started now, Norton might get back to the ship, exhausted, in 4 or 5 hours. That was not the way to handle a AAA priority. "Jerry," he said at length, "who's on the switchboard?" "No one. I'm making the call myself." "Recorder off?" "By an odd breach of regulations, yes." Norton smiled. Jerry was the best exec he had ever worked with. He thought of everything. "Okay. You know where my key is. Call me back." He waited as patiently as he could for the next 10 minutes, trying, without much success, to think of other problems. He hated wasting mental effort. It was unlikely that he could guess the message that was coming, and he would know its contents soon enough. Then he could start worrying effectively. When Kirchhoff called back, he was obviously speaking under considerable strain. "It's not really urgent, Skipper. An hour won't make any difference. But I prefer to avoid radio. I'll send it down by messenger."
"But why?"
"Oh, very well. I trust your judgment. Who will carry it through the airlocks?" "I'm going myself. I'll call you when I reach the hub." "Which leaves Laura in charge." "For 1 hour at the most. I'll get right back to the ship." A medical officer did not have the specialized training to be acting captain, any more than a captain could be expected to perform an operation. In emergencies, the two jobs had sometimes been successfully switched, but it was not recommended. Well, one order had already been broken tonight. "For the record, you never leave the ship. Have you waked Laura?" "Yes, she's delighted to have the opportunity." "Lucky that doctors are used to keeping secrets. Oh, have you sent the acknowledgement?"
"Of course, in your name."
"Then I'll be waiting." Now, it was quite impossible to avoid anxious anticipation. "Not really urgent, but I prefer to avoid radio." One thing was certain. The commander was not going to get much more sleep this night.
36. Bayat Watcher. Sergeant Peter Russo knew why he had volunteered for this job. In many ways, it was a realization of a childhood dream. He had become fascinated by telescopes when he was only 6 or 7 years old, and much of his youth had been spent collecting lenses of all shapes and sizes. These he had mounted in cardboard tubes, making instruments of ever-increasing power until he was familiar with the moon and planets, the nearer space stations,
and the entire landscape within 30 kilometers of his home. He had been lucky in his place of birth, among the mountains of Colorado. In almost every direction, the view was spectacular and inexhaustible. He had spent hours exploring, in perfect safety, the peaks that every year took their toll of careless climbers. Though he had seen much, he had imagined even more. He had liked to pretend that over each crest of rock, beyond the reach of his telescope, were magic kingdoms full of wonderful creatures. And so for years, he had avoided visiting the places his lenses brought to him, because he knew that the reality could not live up to the dream. Now, on the central axis of Rama, he could survey marvels beyond the wildest fantasies of his youth. A whole world lay spread out before him. A small one, it was true, yet a man could spend a lifetime exploring 4,000 square kilometers, even when it was dead and changeless. But now life, with all its infinite possibilities, had come to Rama. If the biological robots were not living creatures, they were certainly very good imitations. No one knew who invented the word biot. It seemed to come into instant use by a kind of spontaneous generation. From his vantage point on the hub, Rousseau was biot watcher in chief, and he was beginning, so he believed, to understand some of their behavior patterns. The spiders were mobile sensors, using vision and probably touch to examine the whole interior of Rama. At one time, there had been hundreds of them rushing around at high speed, but after less than 2 days, most had disappeared. Now it was quite unusual to see even one. They had been replaced by a whole menagerie of much more impressive creatures, and it had been no minor task to think of suitable names for them. There were the window cleaners, with large, padded feet, who were apparently polishing their way the whole length of Rama's 6 artificial suns. Their enormous shadows, cast right across the diameter of the world, sometimes caused temporary eclipses on the far side. The crab that had demolished Dragonfly seemed to be a scavenger. A relay chain of identical creatures had approached Camp Alpha and carried off all the debris that had been neatly stacked on the outskirts. They would have carried off everything else if Norton and Mercer had not stood firm and defied them. The confrontation had been anxious, but brief. Thereafter, the scavengers seemed to understand what they were allowed to touch, and arrived at regular intervals to see if their services were required. It was a most convenient arrangement, and indicated a high degree of intelligence on the part of either the scavengers themselves or some controlling entity elsewhere. Garbage disposal on Rama was simple. Everything was thrown into the sea, where it was presumably broken down into forms that could be used again. The process was rapid. Resolution had disappeared overnight, to the great annoyance of Ruby Barnes. Norton had consoled her by pointing out that it had done its job magnificently, and he would never have allowed anyone to use it again. The sharks might not be as discriminating as the scavengers. No astronomer discovering an unknown planet could have been happier than Rousseau was when he spotted a new type of biot and secured a good photo of it through his telescope. Unfortunately, it seemed that all the interesting species were over at the South Pole, where they were performing mysterious tasks around the horns. Something that looked like a centipede with suction pads could be seen from time to time exploring Bighorn itself, while Rousseau had caught a glimpse of a burly creature around the lower peaks that could have been a cross between a hippopotamus and a bulldozer. And there was even a double-necked giraffe, which apparently acted as a mobile crane. Presumably, Rama, like any ship, required testing, checking, and repairing after its immense voyage. The crew was already hard at work. When would the passengers appear? Biot classifying was not Rousseau's main job. His orders were to keep watch on the two or three exploring parties that were always out, to see that they did not get into trouble, and to warn them if anything approached. He alternated every 6 hours with anyone else who could be spared, though more than once he had been on duty for 12 hours at a stretch. As a result, he now knew the geography of Rama better than any other man who would ever live. It was as familiar to him as the Colorado Mountains of his youth. When Lieutenant Commander Kirchhoff emerged from Airlock Alpha, Rousseau knew at once that something unusual was happening. Personnel transfers never occurred during the sleeping period, and it was now past midnight by mission time. Then Rousseau remembered how short-handed they were, and was shocked by a much more startling irregularity. "Jerry? Who's in charge of the ship?" "I am," said the exec coldly as he flipped open his helmet. "You don't think I'd leave the bridge while I'm on watch, do you?" He reached into his suit carry-all and pulled out a small can bearing the label, "Concentrated Orange Juice, to make 5 liters. "You're good at this, Peter. The skipper is waiting for it." Rousseau hefted the can, then said, "I hope you've put enough mass inside it. Sometimes they get stuck on the first terrace." "Well, you're the expert." That was true enough. The hub observers had had plenty of practice sending down small items that had been forgotten or were needed in a hurry. The trick was to get them safely past the low-gravity region, and then to see that the Coriolis effect did not carry them too far away from the camp during the 8-kilometer roll downhill. Rousseau anchored himself firmly, grasped the can, and hurled it down the face of the cliff. He did not aim directly toward Camp Alpha, but almost 30 degrees away from it. Almost immediately, air resistance robbed the can of its initial speed, but then the pseudo-gravity of Rama took over, and it started to move downward at a constant velocity. It hit once near the base of the ladder and did a slow-motion bounce, which took it clear of the first terrace. "It's okay now," said Rousseau. "Like to make a bet?" "No," was the prompt reply. "You know the odds." "You're no sportsman. But I'll tell you now, it will stop within 300 meters of the camp." "That doesn't sound very close." "You might try it sometime. I once saw Joe miss by a couple of kilometers." The can was no longer bouncing. Gravity had become strong enough to glue it to the curving face of the North Dome. By the time it had reached the second terrace, it was rolling along at 20 or 30 kilometers an hour, and had reached nearly the maximum speed that friction would allow. "Now we'll have to wait," said Rousseau, seating himself at the telescope so that he could keep track of the messenger. "It will be there in 10 minutes. Ah, here comes the skipper. I've got used to recognizing people from this angle. Now he's looking up at us." "I believe that telescope gives you a sense of power." "Oh, it does. I'm the only person who knows everything that's happening in Rama. At least, I thought I did," he added plaintively, giving Kirchhoff a reproachful look. "If it will keep you happy, the skipper found he'd run out of toothpaste." After that, conversation languished, but at last Rousseau said, "Wish you'd taken that bet. He's only got to walk 50 meters. Now he sees it. Mission complete." "Thanks, Peter. A very good job. Now you can go back to sleep." "Sleep?
I'm on watch until 0400.
Sorry. You must have been sleeping, or how else could you have dreamed all this? Space Survey Headquarters to Commander SSS Endeavor. Priority, AAA. Classification, your eyes only. No permanent record. Space Guard reports ultra-high speed vehicle apparently launched Mercury 10 to 12 days ago on Rama Intercept. If no orbit change, arrival predicted, date 322 days, 15 hours. May be necessary you evacuate before then. Will advise further, see in C.
Norton read the message half a dozen times to memorize the date. It was hard to keep track of time inside Rama. He had to look at his calendar watch to see that it was now day 315. That might leave them only 1 week. The message was chilling, not only for what it said, but also for what it implied. The Hermians had made a clandestine launch, which in itself was a breach of space law. The conclusion was obvious. Their vehicle could only be a missile. But why? It was inconceivable, well, almost inconceivable, that they would risk endangering Endeavor. So presumably he would receive ample warning from the Hermians themselves. In an emergency, he could leave at a few hours' notice, though he would do so only under extreme protest, at the direct orders of the Commander-in-Chief. Slowly and thoughtfully, he walked across to the improvised life support complex and dropped the message into an electrosan. The brilliant flare of laser light bursting out through the crack beneath the seat cover told him that the demands of security were satisfied. It was too bad, he told himself, that all problems could not be disposed of so swiftly and hygienically.
37. Missile. The missile was still 5 million kilometers away when the glare of its plasma braking jets became clearly visible in Endeavor's main telescope. By that time, the secret was out, and Norton had reluctantly ordered the second and perhaps final evacuation of Rama. But he had no intention of leaving until events gave him no alternative. When it had completed its braking maneuver, the unwelcome guest from Mercury was only 50 kilometers from Rama, and apparently carrying out a survey through its TV cameras. These were clearly visible, one fore and one aft, as were several small omni-antennas and one large directional dish aimed steadily at the distant star of Mercury. Norton wondered what instructions were coming down that beam and what information was going back. Yet the Hermians could learn nothing that they did not already know. All that Endeavor had discovered had been broadcast throughout the solar system. This spacecraft, which had broken all speed records to get here, could be only an extension of its maker's will, an instrument of their purpose. That purpose would soon be known, for in 3 hours the Hermian ambassador to the United Planets would be addressing the General Assembly. Officially, the missile did not exist. It bore no identification marks and was not radiating on any standard beacon frequency. This was a serious breach of law, but even Space Guard had not yet issued a formal protest. Everyone was waiting, with nervous impatience, to see what Mercury would do next. It had been 3 days since the missile's existence and origin had been announced. All that time, the Hermians had remained stubbornly silent. They could be good at that when it suited them. Some psychologists had claimed that it was almost impossible to understand fully the mentality of anyone
born and bred on Mercury, forever exiled from Earth by its 3 times more powerful gravity, Hermians could stand on the moon and look across the narrow gap to the planet of their ancestors, even of their own parents, but they could never visit it. And so, inevitably, they claimed that they did not want to. They pretended to despise the soft rains, the rolling fields, the lakes and seas, the blue skies, all the things that they could know only through recordings. Because their planet was drenched with such solar energy that the daytime temperature often reached 600 degrees, they affected a rather swaggering toughness that did not bear a moment's serious examination. In fact, they tended to be physically weak, since they could survive only if they were totally insulated from their environment. Even if he could have tolerated the gravity, a Hermian would have been quickly incapacitated by a hot day in any equatorial country on Earth. Yet, in matters that really counted, they were tough. The psychological pressures of that ravening star so close at hand, the engineering problems of tearing into a stubborn planet and wrenching from it all the necessities of life, these had produced a Spartan and, in many ways, highly admirable culture. You could rely on the Hermians. If they promised something, they would do it, though the bill might be considerable. It was their own joke that if the sun ever showed signs of going nova, they would contract to get it under control, once the fee had been settled. It was a non-Hermian joke that any child who showed signs of interest in art, philosophy, or abstract mathematics was plowed straight back into the hydroponic farms. As far as criminals and psychopaths were concerned, this was not a joke at all. Crime was one of the luxuries that Mercury could not afford. Commander Norton had been to Mercury once, had been enormously impressed, like most visitors, and had acquired many Hermian friends. He had fallen in love with a girl in Port Lucifer, and had even contemplated signing a 3-year contract, but parental disapproval of anyone from outside the orbit of Venus had been too strong. It was just as well. "AAA message from Earth, Skipper," said the bridge. "Voice and backup text from Commander-in-Chief. Ready to accept? Check and file text. Let me have the voice. Here it comes." Admiral Hendricks sounded calm and matter-of-fact, as if he were issuing a routine fleet order instead of handling a situation unique in the history of space. But then, he was not 10 kilometers from the bomb.
"CNC to Commander Endeavor. This is a quick summary of the situation as we see it now. You know that the General Assembly meets at 1400, and you'll be listening to the proceedings. It is possible that you may then have to take action immediately, without consultation, hence this briefing. We've analyzed the photos you have sent us. The vehicle is a standard space probe, modified for high impulse and probably laser riding for initial boost. Size and mass are consistent with fusion bomb in the 500 to 1,000 megaton range. The Hermians use up to 100 megatons routinely in their mining operations, so they would have had no difficulty in assembling such a warhead. Our experts also estimate that this would be the minimum size necessary to assure destruction of Rama. If it was detonated against the thinnest part of the shell, underneath the cylindrical sea, the hull would be ruptured, and the spin of the body would complete its disintegration. We assume that the Hermians, if they are planning such an act, will give you ample time to get clear. For your information, the gamma-ray flash from such a bomb could be dangerous to you up to a range of 1,000 kilometers. But that is not the most serious danger. The fragments of Rama, weighing tons and spinning off at almost 1,000 kilometers an hour, could destroy you at an unlimited distance. We therefore recommend that you proceed along the spin axis, since no fragments will be thrown off in that direction. 10,000 kilometers should give an adequate safety margin. This message cannot be intercepted. It is going by multiple pseudo-random routing, so I can talk in clear English. Your reply may not be secure, so speak with discretion and use code when necessary. I will call you immediately after the General Assembly discussion. Message concluded. CNC, out. 38. General Assembly. According to the history books, though no one could really believe it, there had been a time when the old United Nations had 172 members. The United Planets had only 7, and that was sometimes bad enough. In order of distance from the Sun, they were Mercury, Earth, Luna, Mars, Ganymede, Titan, and Triton. The list contained numerous omissions and ambiguities, which presumably the future would rectify. Critics never tired of pointing out that most of the United Planets were not planets at all, but satellites. And how ridiculous that the 4 giants, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, were not included. But no one lived on the gas giants, and quite possibly no one ever would. The same might be true of the other major absentee, Venus. Even the most enthusiastic of planetary engineers agreed that it would take centuries to tame Venus. Meanwhile, the Hermians kept their eyes on it, and doubtless brooded over long-range plans. Separate representation for Earth and Luna had also been a bone of contention. The other members argued that it put too much power in one corner of the solar system, but there were more people on the moon than on all the other worlds except Earth itself, and it was the meeting place of the UP. Moreover, Earth and Moon hardly ever agreed on anything, so they were not likely to constitute a dangerous bloc. Mars held the asteroids in trust, except for the Icarian group, supervised by Mercury, and a handful with perihelions beyond Saturn, and thus claimed by Titan. One day, the larger asteroids, such as Pallas, Vesta, Juno, and Ceres, would be important enough to have their own ambassadors, and the membership of the UP would then reach 2 figures. Ganymede represented not only Jupiter, and therefore more mass than all the rest of the solar system put together, but also the remaining 50 or so Jovian satellites, if one included temporary captures from the asteroid belt, though lawyers were still arguing over this. In the same way, Titan took care of Saturn, its rings, and the other 30-plus satellites. The situation for Triton was even more complicated. The large moon of Neptune was the outermost body in the solar system under permanent habitation. As a result, its ambassador wore a considerable number of hats. He represented Uranus and its 8 moons, none yet occupied. Neptune and its other 3 satellites, Pluto and its solitary moon, and lonely, moonless Persephone. If there were planets beyond Persephone, they, too, would be Triton's responsibility. And, as if that was not enough, the ambassador from outer darkness, as he was sometimes called, had been heard to ask plaintively, "What about comets?" It was generally felt that this problem could be left for the future to solve. And yet, in a real sense, that future was already here. By some definitions, Rama was a comet. They were the only other visitors from the interstellar deeps, and many had traveled on hyperbolic orbits even closer to the sun than Rama's. Any space lawyer could make a good case out of that, and the Hermian ambassador was one of the best. We recognize His Excellency the Ambassador from Mercury.
Because the delegates were arranged counterclockwise in order of distance from the sun, the Hermian was on the President's extreme right. Up to the very last minute he had been interfacing with his computer. Now, he removed the synchronizing spectacles that allowed no one else to read the message on the display screen. He picked up his sheaf of notes and rose briskly to his feet.
Mr. President, distinguished fellow delegates, I would like to begin with a brief summary of the situation which now confronts us.
From some delegates, that phrase, a brief summary, would have evoked silent groans from all listeners, but everyone knew that Hermians meant exactly what they said.
The giant spaceship or artificial asteroid which has been christened Rama was detected over a year ago in the region beyond Jupiter. At first, it was believed to be a natural body, moving on a hyperbolic orbit that would take it around the sun and onto the stars. When its true nature was discovered, the solar survey vessel Endeavour was ordered to rendezvous with it. I am sure we will all want to congratulate Commander Norton and his crew for the efficient way in which they have carried out their unique assignment. At first, it was believed that Rama was dead, frozen for so many hundreds of thousands of years that there was no possibility of revival. This may still be true in a strictly biological sense. There seems general agreement among those who have studied the matter that no living organism of any complexity can survive more than a few centuries of suspended animation. Even at absolute zero, residual quantum effects eventually erase too much cellular information to make revival possible. It therefore appeared that, although Rama was of enormous archaeological importance, it did not present any major astropolitical problems. It is now obvious that this was a very naive attitude, though even from the first, there were some who pointed out that Rama was too precisely aimed at the sun for pure chance to be involved. Even so, it might have been argued, indeed it was argued, that here was an experiment that had failed. Rama had reached the intended target, but the controlling intelligence had not survived. This view also seems very simple-minded. It surely underestimates the entities we are dealing with. What we failed to take into account was the possibility of non-biological survival. If we accept Dr. Pereira's very plausible theory, which certainly fits all the facts, the creatures who have been observed inside Rama did not exist until a short time ago. Their patterns, or templates, were stored in some central information bank, and when the time was ripe, they were manufactured from available raw materials, presumably the organometallic soup of the cylindrical sea. Such a feat is still somewhat beyond our own ability, but does not present any theoretical problems. We know that solid-state circuits, unlike living matter, can store information without loss for indefinite periods of time. So Rama is now in full operating condition, serving the purpose of its builders, whoever they may be. From our point of view, it does not matter if the Ramans themselves have all been dead for a million years, or whether they, too, will be recreated to join their servants at any moment. With or without them, their will is being done, and will continue to be done. Rama has now given proof that its propulsion system is still operating. In a few days, it will be at perihelion, where it would logically make any major orbit change. We may therefore soon have a new planet, moving through the solar space over which my government has jurisdiction. Or it may, of course, make additional changes and occupy a final orbit at any distance from the sun. It could even become a satellite of a major planet, such as Earth. We are therefore, fellow delegates, faced with a whole spectrum of possibilities,
some of them very serious indeed. It is foolish to pretend that these creatures must be benevolent and will not interfere with us in any way. If they come to our solar system, they need something from it, even if it is only scientific knowledge. Consider how that knowledge may be used. What confronts us now is a technology hundreds, perhaps thousands of years in advance of ours, and a culture that may have no points of contact with ours whatsoever. We have been studying the behavior of the biological robots, the Biots, inside Rama, as shown in the films that Commander Norton has relayed, and we have arrived at certain conclusions, which we wish to pass on to you. On Mercury, we are perhaps unlucky in having no indigenous life forms to observe, but, of course, we have a complete record of terrestrial zoology, and we find in it one striking parallel with Rama. This is the termite colony. Like Rama, it is an artificial world with a controlled environment. Like Rama, its functioning depends upon a whole series of specialized biological machines. Workers, builders, farmers, warriors. And although we do not know if Rama has a queen, I suggest that the island known as New York serves a similar function. Now, it would obviously be absurd to press this analogy too far. It breaks down at many points. But I put it to you for this reason. What degree of cooperation or understanding would ever be possible between human beings and termites? When there is no conflict of interest, we tolerate each other. But when either needs the other's territory or resources, no quarter is given. Thanks to our technology and our intelligence, we can always win if we are sufficiently determined. But sometimes it is not easy, and there are those who believe that final victory may go to the termites. With this in mind, consider now the appalling threat that Rama may, I do not say must, present to human civilization. What steps have we taken to counter it if the worst eventuality should occur? None whatsoever. We have merely talked and speculated and written learned papers. Well, my fellow delegates, Mercury has done more than this. Acting under the provisions of Clause 34 of the Space Treaty of 2057, which entitles us to take any steps necessary to protect the integrity of our solar space, we have dispatched a high-energy nuclear device to Rama. We will indeed be happy if we never have to utilize it. But now, at least, we are not helpless, as we were before. It may be argued that we have acted unilaterally, without prior consultation. We admit that. But does anyone here imagine, with all respect, Mr. President, that we could have secured any such agreement in the time available? We consider that we are acting not only for ourselves, but also for the whole human race. All future generations may one day thank us for our foresight. We recognize that it would be a tragedy, even a crime, to destroy an artifact as wonderful as Rama. If there is any way in which this can be avoided without risk to humanity, we will be very happy to hear of it. We have not found one, and time is running out. Within the next few days, before Rama reaches perihelion, the choice will have to be made. We will, of course, give ample warning to Endeavor, but we would advise Commander Norton always to be ready to leave at an hour's notice. It is conceivable that Rama may undergo further dramatic transformations at any moment. That is all, Mr. President, fellow delegates. I thank you for your attention. I look forward to your cooperation. 39. Command Decision.
Well, Boris, how do the Hermians fit into your theology?
Only too well, Commander, replied Lieutenant Rodrigo with a humorless smile. It's the age-old conflict between the forces of good and the forces of evil, and there are times when men have to take sides in such a conflict.
I knew it would be something like that, Norton thought. This situation must have been a shock to Boris, but he would not have resigned himself to passive acquiescence. The Cosmo-Christers were energetic, competent people. Indeed, in some ways, they were remarkably like the Hermians.
I take it you have a plan, Boris?
Yes, Commander. It's really quite simple. We merely have to disable the bomb.
Oh. And how do you propose to do that?
With a small pair of wire cutters. If this had been anyone else, Norton would have assumed that he was joking, but not Boris Rodrigo.
Now, just a minute. It's bristling with cameras. Do you suppose the Hermians will just sit and watch you?
Of course. That's all they can do. When the signal reaches them, it will be far too late. I can easily finish the job in 10 minutes.
I see. They certainly will be mad. But suppose the bomb is booby-trapped so that interference sets it off.
That seems very unlikely. What would be the purpose? This bomb was built for a specific deep space mission, and it will be fitted with all sorts of safety devices to prevent detonation except on a positive command. But that's a risk I'm prepared to take, and it can be done without endangering the ship. I've worked everything out.
I'm sure you have, said Norton. The idea was fascinating, almost seductive in its appeal. He particularly liked the idea of the frustrated Hermians, and would give a good deal to see their reactions when they realized, too late, what was happening to their deadly toy. But there were other complications, and they seemed to multiply as Norton surveyed the problem. He was facing by far the most difficult and the most crucial decision of his entire career. And that was a ridiculous understatement. He was faced with the most difficult decision any commander had ever had to make. The future of the entire human race might well depend upon it. For just suppose the Hermians were right. When Rodrigo had left, Norton switched on the Do Not Disturb sign. He could not remember when he had last used it, and was mildly surprised that it was working. Now, in the heart of his crowded, busy ship, he was completely alone, except for the portrait of Captain James Cook, gazing at him down the corridors of time. It was impossible to consult with Earth. He had already been warned that any messages might be tapped, perhaps by relay devices on the bomb itself. That left the whole responsibility in his hands. There was a story he had heard somewhere about a president of the United States, was it Truman or Perez, who had a sign on his desk saying, "The buck stops here." Norton was not quite certain what a buck was, but he knew when one had stopped at his desk. He could choose to do nothing and wait until the Hermians advised him to leave. How would that look in the histories of the future? Though Norton was not greatly concerned with posthumous fame or infamy, he would not care to be remembered forever as the accessory to a cosmic crime that it had been in his power to prevent. And the plan was flawless. As he would have expected, Rodrigo had worked out every detail, anticipated every possibility, even the remote danger that the bomb might be triggered when tampered with. If that happened, Endeavor could still be safe, behind the shield of Rama. As for Rodrigo himself, he seemed to regard the possibility of instant apotheosis with complete equanimity.
Yet, even if the bomb was successfully disabled, that would be far from the end of the matter. The Hermians might try again, unless some way could be found of stopping them. But at least weeks of time would have been bought. Rama would be far past perihelion before another missile could possibly reach it. By then, the worst fears of the alarmists might have been disproved. Or the reverse. To act or not act, that was the question. Never before had Norton felt such a close kinship with the Prince of Denmark. Whatever he did, the possibilities for good or evil seemed in perfect balance. He was faced with the most morally difficult of all decisions. If his choice was wrong, he would know very quickly. But if he was right, he might never be able to prove it. It was no use relying any further on logical arguments and the endless mapping of alternative futures. That way, one could go around in circles forever. The time had come to listen to his inner voices. He returned the calm, steady gaze of Cook from across the centuries.
"I agree with you, Captain," he whispered. "The human race has to live with its conscience. Whatever the Hermians argue, survival is not everything."
He pressed the call button for the bridge circuit and said slowly, "Lieutenant Rodrigo, I'd like to see you." Then he closed his eyes, hooked his thumbs in the restraining straps of his chair, and prepared to enjoy a few moments of total relaxation. It might be some time before he would experience it again. 40. Saboteur. The scooter had been stripped of all unnecessary equipment. It was now merely an open framework holding together propulsion, guidance, and life support systems. Even the seat for the second pilot had been removed, for every kilogram of extra mass had to be paid for in mission time. That was one of the reasons, though not the most important, why Rodrigo had insisted on going alone. It was such a simple job that there was no need for extra hands, and the mass of a passenger would cost several minutes of flight time. Now the stripped-down scooter could accelerate at over a third of a gravity. It could make the trip from Endeavor to the bomb in 4 minutes. That left 6 to spare. It should be sufficient. Rodrigo looked back only once when he had left the ship. He saw that, as planned, it had lifted from the central axis and was thrusting gently away across the spinning disk of the north face. By the time he reached the bomb, it would have placed the thickness of Rama between them. He took his time flying over the polar plain. There was no hurry here, because the bomb's cameras could not yet see him, and he could therefore conserve fuel. Then he drifted over the curving rim of the world, and there was the missile, glittering in sunlight, fiercer even than that shining on the planet of its birth. Rodrigo had already punched in the guidance instructions. Now he initiated the sequence, and the scooter spun on its gyros and came up to full thrust in a matter of seconds. At first, the sensation of weight seemed crushing. Then Rodrigo adjusted to it. He had, after all, comfortably endured twice as much inside Rama, and had been born under 3 times as much on Earth. The huge, curving exterior wall of the 50-kilometer cylinder was slowly falling away beneath him as the scooter aimed itself directly at the bomb. Yet it was impossible to judge Rama's size, since it was completely smooth and so lacking in features that it was difficult to tell that it was spinning. 100 seconds into the mission, he was approaching the halfway point. The bomb was too far away to show any details, but it was much brighter against the jet-black sky. It was strange to see no stars, not even brilliant Earth or dazzling Venus. The dark filters which protected his eyes against the deadly glare made that impossible. Rodrigo guessed that he was breaking a record. Probably no other man had ever engaged in extravehicular work so close to the sun. It was lucky for him that solar activity was low. At 2:10, the flip-over light started flashing. Thrust dropped to zero, and the scooter spun through 180 degrees. Full thrust was back in an instant, but now he was decelerating at the same mad rate of 3 meters per second squared. Rather better than that, in fact, since he had lost almost half his propellant mass. The bomb was 25 kilometers away. He would be there in another 2 minutes. He had hit a top speed of 1,500 kilometers per hour, which, for a space scooter, was utter insanity, and probably another record. But this was hardly a routine EVA, and he knew precisely what he was doing. The bomb was growing, and now he could see the main antenna holding steady on the invisible star of Mercury. Along that beam, the image of his approaching scooter had been flashing at the speed of light for the last 3 minutes. There were still 2 to go before it reached Mercury. What would the Hermians do when they saw him? There would be consternation, of course. They would realize instantly that he had made a rendezvous with the bomb several minutes before they even knew he was on the way. Probably some standby observer would call higher authority. That would take more time. But even in the worst possible case, even if the officer on duty had authority to detonate the bomb and pressed the button immediately, it would take another 5 minutes for the signal to arrive. Though Rodrigo was not gambling on it, Cosmo Chrysters never gambled, he was quite sure that there would be no such instantaneous reaction. The Hermians would hesitate to destroy a reconnaissance vehicle from Endeavor, even if they suspected its motives. They would certainly attempt some form of communication first, and that would mean more delay. And there was an even better reason. They would not waste a gigaton bomb on a mere scooter. Wasted it would be if it was detonated 20 kilometers from its target. They would have to move it first. Oh, he had plenty of time. But he would continue to assume the worst. He would act as if the triggering impulse were going to arrive in the shortest possible time. Just 5 minutes. As the scooter closed in across the last few hundred meters, Rodrigo quickly matched the details he could now see with those he had studied in the photographs taken at long range. What had been only a collection of pictures became hard metal and smooth plastic, no longer abstract, but a deadly reality. The bomb was a cylinder about 10 meters long and 3 in diameter, by a strange coincidence, almost the same proportions as those of Rama. It was attached to the framework of the carrier vehicle by an open latticework of short I-beams. For some reason, probably to do with the location of the center of mass, it was supported at right angles to the axis of the carrier, so that it conveyed an appropriately sinister hammerhead impression. It was indeed a hammer, one powerful enough to smash a world. From each end of the bomb, a bundle of braided cables ran along the cylindrical side and disappeared through the latticework into the interior of the vehicle. All communication and control was here. There was no antenna of any kind on the bomb itself. Rodrigo had only to cut those two sets of cables, and there would be nothing left but harmless, inert metal. Although this was exactly what he had expected, it seemed a little too easy. He glanced at his watch. It would be another 30 seconds before the Hermians, even if they had been watching when he rounded the edge of Rama, could know of his existence. He had an absolutely certain 5 minutes for uninterrupted work, and a 99% probability of much longer than that. As soon as the scooter had drifted to a complete halt, Rodrigo grappled it to the missile framework so that the two formed a rigid structure. That took only seconds. He had already chosen his tools and was out of the pilot's seat at once, only slightly hampered by the stiffness of his heavy insulation suit. The first thing he found himself inspecting was a small metal plate bearing this inscription: Department of Power Engineering, Section D, 47 Sunset Boulevard, Vulcanopolis, 17464. For information, apply to Henry K. Jones. Rodrigo suspected that in a very few minutes, Mr. Jones might be rather busy. The heavy wire cutters made short work of the cable. As the first strands parted, Rodrigo gave scarcely a thought to the fires of hell that were pent up only centimeters away. If his actions triggered them, he would never know. He glanced again at his watch. This had taken less than a minute, which meant that he was on schedule. Now for the backup cable, and then he could head for home, in full view of the furious and frustrated Hermians. He was just beginning to work on the second cable assembly when he felt a faint vibration in the metal he was touching. Startled, he looked back along the body of the missile. The characteristic blue-violet glow of a plasma thruster in action was hovering around one of the attitude control jets. The bomb was preparing to move. The message from Mercury was brief and devastating. It arrived 2 minutes after Rodrigo had disappeared around the edge of Rama. Commander Endeavor from Mercury Space Control, Inferno West. You have 1 hour from receipt of this message to leave vicinity of Rama. Suggest you proceed maximum acceleration along spin axis. Request acknowledgement. Message ends. Norton read it with sheer disbelief, followed by anger. He felt a childish impulse to radio back that all his crew were inside Rama and it would take hours to get everyone out. But that would achieve nothing, except perhaps to test the will and nerve of the Hermians. And why, several days before perihelion, had they decided to act? He wondered if the mounting pressure of public opinion was becoming too great, and they had decided to present the rest of the human race with a fait accompli. It seemed an unlikely explanation, because such sensitivity would have been uncharacteristic. There was no way in which he could recall Rodrigo, for the scooter was now in the radio shadow of Rama and would be out of contact until they were in line of sight again. That would not be until the mission was completed or had failed. He would have to wait it out. There was still plenty of time, a full 50 minutes. Meanwhile, he had decided on the most effective answer to Mercury. He would ignore the message completely and see what the Hermians did next. Rodrigo's first sensation when the bomb started to move was not one of physical fear. It was something much more devastating. He believed that the universe operated according to strict laws, which not even God could disobey, much less the Hermians. No message could travel faster than light. He was 5 minutes ahead of anything that Mercury could do. This could only be a coincidence. Fantastic and perhaps deadly, but no more than that. By chance, a control signal must have been sent.